Imagine you're out there constructing what you think is this just totally bulletproof portfolio.
Right.
You buy like 50 different bonds, and you're thinking, I've built an impenetrable fortress of diversification here. But then you decide to just move across state lines. And in an instant, like without a single one of those bonds defaulting, your yields are effectively just underwater,
Exactly.
and your tax liabilities absolutely explode.
Yeah, it's a disaster.
Today, we are navigating the hidden tripwires of municipal bond analysis for the Series 7. And before we dive into the actual mechanics of why that nightmare scenario happens, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel.
Right.
So if you're studying for the Series 7, they've got this full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Which is huge.
Yeah, exactly. So it helps you figure out what you actually need to focus on. Check it out at certfuel.com.
So that scenario you just described, the cross-state move, that is a perfect example of why rote memorization just completely fails on test day.
Right.
Like if you just memorize the phrase, municipal bonds are tax exempt, you will walk right into the trap.
Because it's not that simple.
No, not at all. You
Yeah.
have to understand the underlying mechanics of how these instruments actually functioned in the real world.
Which is exactly our mission today. We are looking at municipal analysis and pricing. And to keep this from turning into, a super dry recitation of financial rules, we're going to run these concepts through a pretty consistent set of case
I
studies.
love this approach.
Yeah, so we have three archetypes we're going to be following today. First, we have Mayor Mike of Mudville.
Okay, Mayor Mike.
Yeah, he represents the cash-strapped municipal issuer, right? He's constantly trying to fund local infrastructure without sparking a massive taxpayer revolt.
It is the classic local government dilemma, for sure.
Totally. And then we have our retail trader, who we will call Dizzy Dave.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah, Dave represents the overly confident, sort of do-it-yourself retail investor.
Well,
Like, he knows just enough financial jargon to be dangerous.
yeah, I mean, we have all seen a portfolio built by a Dave.
Absolutely. He consistently falls for all the structural traps that the exam really loves to test.
Yeah, he's the guy making the classic mistakes.
And finally, we have Calculating Kathy.
Okay.
She is the institutional desk analyst, just
I
cold, precise, completely unsentimental.
feels the math.
Oh, she knows the math, the tax codes, the structural risk. So whenever we introduce a new rule today, we are going to look at it through the lens of Mike issuing it, Dave completely misinterpreting it, or Kathy, pricing it flawlessly.
I think that's the best way to approach this material because, well, before Mayor Mike can even structure a bond for Mudville,
Yeah.
we need to understand the psychology of the buyer.
Right.
Like, why is someone like our retail investor, Dave, putting his capital into municipal debt in the first place? And how does he fundamentally misunderstand portfolio construction?
So let's look at Dave's current setup. He knows the word diversification, right? It's hammered into every investor's head from day one. So Dave goes out and he buys 50 different municipal bonds.
Right.
And they are all from the state of New York. They are all general obligation bonds, and they all carry an A credit rating.
Oh boy.
Yeah, so he looks at a spreadsheet, he sees 50 line items, and he just assumes he is heavily diversified.
Right. And if you look at the actual mechanics of what he just built, he has zero actual diversification.
None. It's the equivalent of like buying 50 different types of umbrellas.
Yeah.
He's got golf umbrellas, compact umbrellas, those clear plastic dome ones.
Right.
But he chooses to live in the Atacama Desert where it hasn't rained in like 400 years.
That is a great way to put it.
Just having a large quantity of assets doesn't equal diversification if they all react to the exact same macroeconomic trigger.
Exactly. I mean, institutional analysts like Kathy, they look at a well-diversified municipal portfolio across three distinct dimensions.
Okay, what are the three?
You've got geography, bond type, and credit rating. So geography means you are intentionally mixing up states and regions. That way, if there's a local recession in one area, it doesn't wipe you out.
Right.
And bond type means blending general obligation bonds, which rely on taxes, with revenue bonds, which rely on facility usage.
Okay.
And then rating means holding a deliberate mix of AAA, A-lay, and maybe some A-rated bonds to, balance your yield against your safety requirements.
So by going all New York, all go, and all A-rated, Dave has built a portfolio that is essentially a structural sitting duck.
Totally.
Like if the New York State Legislature faces a massive budget shortfall, all 50 of his bonds are going to suffer downgrades simultaneously.
Yep.
There's absolutely no counterbalance in there.
Exactly. There's nowhere to hide. But let's take this a step further and look at the tax implications.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is a highly testable concept for the exam.
Okay, I'll put a direct question to the listener right here. I want you to pause and actually think through this scenario.
Let's do it.
Let's say Dave currently lives in New York. He loves his New York heavy muni portfolio because he is getting that in-state tax exemption.
Right.
But Dave decides he wants warmer weather and no state income tax, so he packs up and moves to Texas.
Yep.
What happens to the math on his New York heavy muni portfolio the second he changes his residency? I'll give you a beat to think about it.
Yeah, this is like a classic blind spot for retail investors.
Yeah.
And examiners really love to probe this exact vulnerability.
So what is the actual outcome here for Dave?
Well, Dave just triggered what we call the double risk of geographic concentration.
Okay.
First, as we established, his portfolio was never geographically insulated. If New York's economy contracts, his net worth drops.
All right.
But the immediate mathematical hit is that by establishing residency in Texas, he instantly loses his in-state tax exemption on every single one of those New York bonds.
Oh, man. Because you have to think about why the exemption exists in the first place, right?
Exactly.
A state offers you a tax break as an incentive to fund their local infrastructure.
Mm.
Texas has zero interest in subsidizing the construction of bridges in upstate New York.
None at all.
So they are going to fully tax the interest Dave receives from those New York bonds.
And that fundamentally destroys his yield profile. You know, remember, municipal bonds naturally offer lower coupon rates than corporate bonds, specifically because of that tax-exempt status.
Right. Investors accept a lower yield in exchange for the tax break.
Yeah, exactly. So Dave is now holding bonds with mathematically lower yields, but he is paying state taxes on them anyway.
Wow.
He is absorbing all the geographic risk with absolutely none of the state tax reward.
So if you see an investor moving out of state on the exam, your brain should just immediately flag that they are losing the in-state tax exemption.
Mm-hmm.
And their taxable equivalent yield just fell off a cliff.
Yeah, that is the big takeaway. So Dave now understands that he needs to diversify across geography, type, and rating.
Right.
But to do that, he needs to understand the actual instruments he is buying. Which brings us to evaluating Mayor Mike's offerings in Mudville.
Let's do it.
Let's start with the absolute cornerstone of municipal finance, which is general obligation or GIGO bonds.
Okay, so when Mayor Mike issues a GIGO bond, he is tapping directly into the tax base of Mudville.
Right.
These are backed by the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the municipality. He is effectively telling the bondholders, hey, I promise to pay you back, and if the city coffers run dry, I am legally obligated to raise property taxes on my citizens until you are made whole.
Yeah, and because of that specific structure, an institutional analyst like Kathy doesn't really look at the specific project being built.
Oh, she doesn't care if it's a town hall or whatever.
No, she doesn't care if it's a new town hall or a public park. She analyzes the systemic health of Mudville itself.
Okay.
She tracks population migration, the diversity of local employers, and assessed property valuations. Property taxes are the absolute engine of a JGO bond.
Gotcha. So let's test that logic with another direct question for the listener. Imagine Mayor Mike raises property taxes so high to pay for these bonds that half the population of Mudville just gets fed up, packs up moving trucks, and leaves town.
Right.
Does Mudville's debt per capita ratio get better or does it get worse?
Think carefully about the denominator in that equation.
The population is cut in half.
Yeah.
But the debt stays the same. So the ratio gets drastically worse.
Yeah. The mechanics here are pretty straightforward but critical. Net debt per capita is the total municipal debt divided by the population.
Okay.
If Mudville owes $10 million and half the taxpayers vanish, that exact same $10 million burden is now resting squarely on the shoulders of the residents who stayed behind.
It is basically the worst dinner party imaginable.
Oh, absolutely.
Like you go out with 10 friends, you rack up a huge bill, and then five of them just sneak out the back door before the check arrives.
Yep.
The restaurant's bill didn't change at all, but your personal financial liability just doubled.
That dynamic applies directly to assessed property valuations as well. You know,
right.
If people leave and property values plummet, the net debt to assessed valuation ratio deteriorates because that massive fixed debt is now supported by a shrinking pool of taxable real estate.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's dig into how analysts calculate that overall debt burden, because there is a massive exam trap hiding in the definitions of net direct debt and overlapping debt.
Oh yeah, this is an area where test takers frequently stumble.
Really?
Yeah. So net direct debt is the debt issued directly by the municipality.
Right.
But it explicitly excludes revenue bonds.
Wait, I want to challenge that. Mudville is the issuer of the revenue bond. It literally has their name right there on the prospectus.
Right.
So why would an analyst back it out of the city's debt profile?
Because the analyst is trying to determine the burden on the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. Revenue bonds are entirely self-supporting. They pay for themselves through the user fees generated by the specific facility.
It's like a toll bridge or something.
Exactly, a toll bridge or a hospital. Since they don't draw a single dime from the local property tax base, they don't represent a liability to the average citizen's tax bill.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. You isolate the debt that the taxpayers are actually on the hook for.
Exactly.
Okay, so that is net direct debt. What about overlapping debt?
So overlapping debt occurs when multiple distinct municipal authorities have the legal right to tax the exact same piece of physical property.
Okay.
So Mudville might be located inside a larger county, and it might share borders with a regional school district.
Right.
So a homeowner in Mudville pays city property taxes, county property taxes, and school district property taxes.
Yeah, that's a lot of taxes.
Yeah, it adds up. So the overlapping debt calculation includes all of those coterminous authorities. But here's the critical distinction. It strictly excludes state debt.
Okay, let me make sure I have the mechanism right on this one. Overlapping debt is like me and my roommate signing a lease together. We share the same physical apartment, so we share the local financial burden of the rent. That is the city and the county.
Mm-hmm.
State debt, on the other hand, is like my dad's mortgage.
Right.
We live in the same state, we're related, but if he defaults on his house, the bank has absolutely no legal authority to come repossess my couch.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. The state government operates on entirely different revenue mechanisms.
Okay.
States typically fund themselves through broad income taxes and sales taxes. They do not levy local physical property taxes.
Oh, I see.
Therefore, state debt never hits the local property tax assessment. On the exam, if they give you a list of local jurisdictions to calculate overlapping debt, you add up the city, the county, the school district, the local park authority.
But what about the state?
The second you see state debt in that column, you zero it out.
Yeah.
It is a distractor.
It's a trap designed to test if you actually understand the different mechanisms of taxation.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mayor Mike realizes his property tax base is just completely tapped out.
He's desperate.
Yeah, the citizens will revolt if he raises their assessments one more time. But he still needs to build infrastructure to keep the city moving. So he looks at a map and decides to build the Mudville Megatoll Road.
Okay, big project.
Huge. How does he finance a massive infrastructure project without touching the local property tax base?
Well, this is where Mayor Mike pivots from general obligation bonds to revenue bonds.
Ah.
And as an analyst, Kathy's entire evaluation process shifts. She no longer cares about Mudville's population trends or property values at all.
Because it's not a GOAT bond.
Exactly. This is pure project finance.
Because the bond is backed exclusively by the quarters tossed into the toll booths.
Exactly. So the absolute first piece of documentation Kathy demands to see is the feasibility study.
What's that?
An independent engineering firm has to conduct traffic analyses and certify that enough commuters actually want to drive through Mudville to generate the revenue required to pay off the construction debt.
Right. And once the toll road is built and those quarters start rolling in, we have to establish the flow of funds.
Yeah, the flow of funds is crucial.
This is the legal hierarchy of who gets paid out of the cash register first.
Right.
And the exam heavily tests the distinction between a gross revenue pledge and a net revenue pledge.
So let's trace a dollar as it moves through the system.
Okay.
Under a gross revenue pledge, the bondholders are at the absolute front of the line.
Mm.
The debt service is paid straight off the top before a single dime is spent on operating or maintaining the toll road.
Wow. Okay. So the memory aid here is pretty simple. Gross equals given priority.
Yes, I like that.
The bondholders get the gross revenues before any other expenses.
Right. Conversely, under a net revenue pledge, the essential operations and maintenance costs, the O&M, those are paid first.
Okay, why is that?
Well, you have to pay the toll booth operators and fill the potholes to keep the revenue flowing, right?
Oh, yeah. If the road is closed, nobody pays the toll.
Exactly. So the bondholders are then paid from whatever net revenues are left over after the facility's basic upkeep is covered.
Okay, so net equals not until O&M is paid. Gross is given priority. Net is not until O&M.
Yeah.
Now, Kathy is scrutinizing these projected revenues, and she is running the debt service coverage ratio, right? The DSCR.
Yeah, the DSCR is the vital sign of a revenue bond. It is calculated by dividing the project's net operating income by its annual debt service obligation.
What does that actually tell us, though?
It measures the size of the safety cushion.
Okay, so if the toll road has a DSCR of 2.0x, it means the facility is generating twice as much cash as it needs to make its bond payments.
Right.
Which is a massive margin of error. 2.0 is generally the gold standard for solid projects.
Yes, it is.
But the exam loves to throw a specific exception at you. Utility bonds, like municipal water and sewer systems.
Test takers often assume that a lower coverage ratio always implies a toxic bond. But for a municipal water or sewer system, a DSCR of 1.25x is considered perfectly healthy and standard.
Wait, why would a ruthless institutional analyst like Kathy accept a much smaller safety cushion?
That's a good question.
Because mathematically, a 1.25x cushion feels infinitely riskier than a 2.0x cushion.
It comes down to the economic elasticity of demand. Think about human behavior during a severe recession.
Okay.
If the economy crashes, people stop taking road trips.
Yeah.
They avoid the toll road to save money.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So toll roads revenue is highly volatile. You know, it needs a huge 2.0x cushion to survive a downturn.
Right.
But a municipal sewer system, no matter how bad the economy gets, people are still turning on their tap water.
Right, hopefully.
Yeah, they're still flushing their toilets. It is an absolute necessity. Because the revenue stream of a water utility is incredibly stable and predictable, the project doesn't require a massive safety buffer.
Ah.
So the 1.25x cushion is plenty to ensure the debt service is covered.
See, that is the difference between just memorizing a number and actually understanding the market.
Exactly.
Water is inelastic. Toll roads are a luxury.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's look at what happens after these bonds are issued. Mayor Mike built his toll road. The bonds are out in the world. And Dizzy Dave bought a chunk of them.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah. But Dave, being highly reactive, reads a scary headline about the economy and decides he needs to liquidate his bonds immediately.
Of course he does.
Which brings us to the secondary market.
We have to evaluate the marketability of Dave's holdings. How quickly and at what price can he actually find a buyer on the open market?
Right. And generally speaking, institutional buyers want liquidity.
Yes.
They want high credit ratings, shorter maturities, recognizable issuer names like, you know, State of New York.
Right.
And standard block sizes, usually pieces of $100,000 or more.
But Dave, liking capital, bought what we call odd lots, maybe $10,000 worth of bonds.
Wait, I would assume smaller pieces are easier to sell.
You think so, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's cheaper. More people can afford a $10,000 bond than a $100,000 block.
It seems intuitive, but it's the exact opposite in the institutional market. Clearing firms and institutional desks like Kathy's absolutely despise odd lots.
Why?
Because the transaction costs and administrative overhead of processing a $10,000 trade are essentially the same as processing a $1 million trade.
Oh, so the margins just disappear.
The margins disappear completely. Huh. So if Dave tries to sell an odd lot, he's going to take a massive haircut on the price just to get a desk to take it off his hands.
Wow, okay. And Dave also thought he was being clever, right? He bought callable bonds.
Right.
He saw the word callable and assumed it was some sort of premium feature for him.
Yeah, and this is one of the most vital concepts for the Series 7. A call feature is absolutely not a benefit to the investor.
No.
Not at all. It is a massive structural advantage for the issuer, Mayor Mike. And it introduces severe reinvestment risk for Dave.
Okay, let's walk through the actual mechanics of a call so people can see why it's so bad for Dave.
Sure. Let's say Dave buys a bond yielding 5%. A few years later, the macroeconomic environment changes and interest rates drop to 3%.
Okay.
Mayor Mike realizes he is overpaying for his debt. So he exercises his right to call the bond.
Right.
He sources Dave to hand the bond back, pays Dave his principal, and Mike issues brand new debt at the lower 3% rate.
Oh, wow. So Dave gets a pile of cash handed back to him at the exact moment in the economic cycle when interest rates are terrible.
Exactly.
He takes that cash, goes back into the market, and the best yield he can find is now 3%. His income stream just got completely crushed.
Yep. Because the call feature only benefits the issuer, Buyers in the secondary market demand a price concession for taking on that reinvestment risk.
That makes total sense.
So callable bonds are inherently less marketable and trade at lower prices than identical non-callable bonds.
But reinvestment risk is nothing compared to what happens next in Mudville.
Oh no, what happens?
Let's imagine the absolute worst case scenario. The feasibility study was completely wrong. A massive sinkhole swallows the Mudville Megatoll Road. Nobody is paying tolls. Mayor Mike's project is totally insolvent.
A disaster.
The bonds officially go into default.
Right. And a default fundamentally rewires how a bond trades and settles in the secondary market.
How so?
Normally, when a bond trades hands between coupon dates, it is accruing interest every single day.
Right. Like if Kathy holds a normal bond for 3 months and then sells it to Dave, Dave has to pay her for those 3 months of accrued interest out of his own pocket at settlement.
Exactly.
Because the issuer is eventually going to send Dave the full six-month check.
But when a bond defaults, the exam will use a very specific industry term. It begins to trade flat.
What is the actual mechanical definition of trading flat?
It means the bond trades without any accrued interest added to the settlement price. The buyer pays exactly zero accrued interest to the seller.
Which makes perfect logical sense.
Yeah.
Mayor Mike is broke. He has stopped sending checks. Why would Dave compensate Kathy for 3 months of interest when they both know the issuer is never going to pay it out?
Precisely. The price of a defaulted bond drops to reflect only its raw recovery value.
Gotcha.
So Kathy looks at the collapsed toll road, estimates they can sell the scrap metal for maybe 10 cents on the dollar, and offers Dave exactly that. No interest, just the deeply discounted principal recovery.
Now here's where examiners really like to weave a tangled web. Defaulted bonds trade flat, but income bonds and zero coupon bonds also trade flat, and the reasons are entirely different.
Yeah, you have to be able to delineate the why for each instrument. As we covered, a defaulted bond trades flat because the issuer is structurally insolvent.
Right.
But an income bond, which by the way is a corporate restructuring tool, not a municipal bond.
Okay, good to note.
An income bond trades flat because the interest payments are contingent upon the corporation actually generating enough earnings. There is no guaranteed accrual of interest, so it trades flat.
Okay, and a zero coupon bond trades flat because it's literally in the name, right? There are zero semi-annual coupons. It was issued at a deep discount and matures at par. Since there are no periodic interest checks to fight over, there is zero accrued interest to calculate at settlement.
Yep. If you see the phrase trades flat, recognize that it simply means the buyer pays zero accrued interest. The exam will test if you can identify which of those specific bonds operate under that rule and the distinct logic behind each.
Let's shift gears and step onto the trading floor.
Okay.
Dave is trying to navigate the secondary market, but the pricing screens look like a foreign language to him. This is where Calculating Kathy thrives. Let's look at how the pros quote and price municipal debt.
When Kathy pulls up her terminal, she's dealing with two primary structures, term bonds and serial bonds. And they are quoted completely differently.
So term bond means the entire issue matures on one single date.
Right.
Because they all share the exact same lifespan, they are quoted in dollar price, which is really just a percentage of par.
Yeah.
So if Dave sees a quote of 98, he isn't paying $98. He is paying 98% of $1,000 par value, which is $980.
Exactly. Serial bonds, however, mature in staggered intervals over several years. Like a series of steps.
Okay.
Because each tranche has a different lifespan, quoting a single dollar price would be chaotic.
Yeah, that would be a mess.
Instead, serial bonds are quoted in yield, specifically yield to maturity, or what traders call a basis quote.
Gotcha.
If Kathy quotes a serial bond of 5.00 basis, she is saying the bond is priced to yield exactly 5% to maturity.
Okay, let's talk about the calendar math behind these trades. Because if you use normal human logic here, you will absolutely fail the question.
100%.
Let's say Dave is buying a healthy performing bond from Kathy, and they need to calculate the accrued interest for the settlement. What calendar do they use?
For both municipal and corporate bonds, the industry uses the 3360 day count convention.
I just want to highlight the sheer absurdity of this.
It is pretty wild.
Under this convention, the financial industry agrees to pretend that every single month has exactly 30 days. In Muniland, February magically has 30 days.
It sounds ridiculous today, but you have to look at the history.
Why did they do this?
Before the era of algorithmic trading and computers, bond clerks were calculating fractional interest by hand on chalkboards and paper ledgers.
Wow, chalkboards.
Literally. So standardizing every month to 30 days made the manual math significantly faster and way less prone to error.
Okay, so it was just for convenience.
Yeah, if a coupon pays on March 1st and the next is August 1st, you don't count days on a calendar. You just take 5 full months, multiply by 30 days, and you have exactly 150 days of accrued interest.
But here is the trapdoor. If you are calculating accrued interest for a U.S. Treasury bond, the government does not play the 3360 game.
No, they do not. Treasuries use the actual day count convention.
Meaning?
You have to count the literal days on a calendar, accounting for 28 days in February or 29 in the leap year.
Right. Do not mix them up on the exam. Municipal and corporate equal 3360. Treasuries equal actual.
Exactly. So once Kathy calculates her settlement, she needs to compare the bond's yield to the broader market. And since munis are tax-free, comparing a muni yield directly to a taxable corporate yield is like comparing apples to heavily taxed oranges.
Right.
She has to use the taxable equivalent yield, or TEY.
Okay, the TEY formula basically levels the playing field. It shows you what a taxable corporate bond would mathematically have to yield to match the after-tax take-home pay of the tax-free muni.
Exactly.
And the formula is the municipal yield divided by 1 minus the investor's tax rate.
Yes.
Let me pause right there. The most common mistake test takers make is multiplying the yield by the tax bracket.
Oh, yeah. I see that all the time.
If you multiply, the number gets smaller, which completely defeats the purpose.
Mm.
You are trying to gross up the muni yield to see its true power. You must divide.
Yes, divide. Do not multiply.
Let's run Kathy and Dave through this formula to prove why tax brackets matter so much in municipal finance.
Sure. Let's say Mayor Mike issues a bond yielding 4%. Dave is a retail worker in the 12% tax bracket.
Okay.
If Dave buys it, his TEY is 4% divided by 0.88. That equals a taxable equivalent of roughly 4.5%.
Yep.
Dave might look at that and realize he can easily find a taxable corporate bond yielding 5% or 6%, which would put more money in his pocket even after taxes.
So for Dave, the muni is actually a bad deal.
Exactly. But Kathy is an institutional managing director in the absolute highest federal tax bracket, let's say 37%.
Okay.
Her formula is 4% divided by 0.63. Her taxable equivalent yield is over 6.3%.
Wow.
Yeah, because the IRS is taking such a massive bite out of Kathy's taxable investments, the protective shield of the municipal bond is immensely valuable to her.
Right.
To match the take-home cash of that simple 4% muni, Kathy would have to hunt down a corporate bond yielding well over 6%, which carries significantly more default risk.
So the fundamental takeaway here is that higher tax brackets make municipal bonds exponentially more attractive. The rich investor extracts the most power from the tax exemption.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. And speaking of yields, we also need to understand the structural hierarchy of yields when a bond is trading at a premium in the secondary market.
Okay.
We call this the yield seesaw.
Picture a staircase leading down. When Dave buys a bond at a premium, say he pays $1,050 for a bond with a $1,000 par value.
Right.
He has mathematically guaranteed that he will lose $50 of principal when the bond eventually matures.
Yep.
That built-in capital loss acts as a heavyweight, just dragging his yields down in a very specific sequential order.
So at the absolute top of the staircase is the coupon rate, let's say 5%, that is fixed and never changes.
Okay.
One step down is the current yield. Because Dave paid $1,050 instead of $1,000, his $50 of annual interest represents a slightly lower percentage return on his actual invested capital.
Makes sense.
The next step down is yield to maturity. This yield factors in the fact that Dave is going to lose that $50 premium over the entire, say, 10-year lifespan of the bond.
But the bottom step, the absolute lowest point on the staircase for a premium callable bond, is the yield to call.
Yes.
Why is it lower than yield to maturity?
Because of time compression. If Mayor Mike calls that bond in 3 years instead of 10 years, Dave still loses the exact same $50 premium, but he suffers that capital loss over a brutally short time frame.
Ouch.
Yeah, it accelerates the drag on his annualized return.
So for a premium callable bond, the hierarchy is always yield to call is less than yield to maturity, which is less than current yield, which is less than the nominal coupon.
Right. If the exam asks you which yield is the lowest for a premium callable bond, or which yield a broker must quote to a customer under MSRB rules, it is invariably the yield to call.
You always quote the worst case scenario.
Always.
Okay, so Kathy might have priced that bond perfectly, analyzed the yields, and executed the trade flawlessly. But none of that matters if she fundamentally misunderstands her liability to the federal government.
That is very true.
Let's look at how the IRS views the municipal market, because the tax code is just littered with traps.
The baseline rule is pretty simple. The interest income generated by a municipal bond is exempt from federal income tax.
And if you acquire bonds issued by U.S. territories, like Puerto Rico, Guam, or the U.S. Virgin Islands, they carry a coveted triple tax exemption.
Right.
Federal, state, and local taxes are waived regardless of where you live in the United States.
But the IRS gets incredibly aggressive when dealing with how investors handle the premiums and discounts on their tax accounting. Let's start with premium amortization.
Okay, going back to Dave paying $1,050 for a tax-exempt muni.
Right.
The IRS requires him to amortize that $50 premium over the remaining life of the bond.
Yes.
If it's a 10-year bond, he has to walk his cost basis down by $5 every single year.
And here is the trap. For a tax-exempt municipal bond, that premium amortization is absolutely mandatory, and it is strictly non-deductible.
Yeah, it is the ultimate IRS double whammy.
Yeah, it is.
I want to push back and ask why the IRS is so punitive here. Why force me to do the accounting if I don't get a write-off?
Well, think about it from the IRS's perspective.
Yeah.
You are collecting interest on this bond completely tax-free.
Yeah,
the government is already subsidizing your income. They are absolutely not going to let you claim a capital loss on the premium you paid to acquire that untaxed income.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. They force you to walk down the basis so that if you hold it to maturity, your basis is exactly $1,000,
yeah,
and you generate zero capital loss. Mandatory accounting, zero tax deduction.
Ouch. Now let's look at the flip side, buying bonds at a discount.
Mm.
The exam focuses heavily on distinguishing between original issue discount, or OID, and market discount.
Yes.
If you get these two confused, you will miscalculate the entire tax liability.
We have to look at who created the discount. Was it the issuer in the primary market or the trader in the secondary market?
Okay.
Let's look at OID first. An original issue discount is created by Mayor Mike. He issues a brand new 10-year bond, but instead of selling it at $1,000 par, he prices the initial offering at $900 to aggressively attract buyers.
Because the municipality deliberately structured the bond this way at birth, the IRS treats the $100 discount as a form of substitute interest. So as that bond mathematically accretes in value from $900 up to $1,000 over 10 years, that annual accretion is treated exactly like the coupon payments. It is completely tax-free.
Contrast that with a market discount. This bond was issued normally at $1,000 par.
Okay.
But a few years later, macro interest rates spike, bond prices broadly collapse, and Dizzy Dave manages to buy that exact same bond from another investor in the secondary market for $900.
So Dave thinks he's a genius.
Of course.
He scored a cheap bond, but Dave didn't buy an OID. He bought a market discount.
Right.
Because Dave capitalized on secondary market price fluctuations, the IRS views that $100 profit very differently. When the bond matures at $1,000 or when Dave sells it for a profit, that market discount is taxed as ordinary income.
Listen to the mechanics. Original issue discount equals tax-free accretion. Market discount equals fully taxable ordinary income.
But wait, the IRS does have a tiny loophole for market discounts known as the de minimis rule.
Yes, they do. If the market discount is incredibly small, specifically less than 0.25% of par multiplied by the years to maturity, the IRS essentially shrugs it off as a fractional accounting variance.
Okay.
If the discount is below that threshold, the IRS cuts you a break and treats the profit as a capital gain, which enjoys a much lower tax rate than ordinary income.
But this is where the IRS acts like a ruthless casino bouncer.
Oh, yeah.
If your market discount exceeds that de minimis threshold by even one single penny, what happens? Most tax brackets are progressive. You know, you only pay the higher rate on the money over the line.
Not here. The de minimis rule is a complete cliff effect.
A cliff.
If you breach the threshold by a fraction of a cent, the capital gains protection vaporizes, and the entire discount is subjected to the brutal ordinary income tax rate. It is an all-or-nothing trapdoor.
Man, do not let Dave drag you down with him on that one. Cross the line, the whole thing is ordinary income.
Yep.
Let's hit two more quick tax scenarios before we leave the IRS. AMT and bank-qualified bonds.
Okay, AMT stands for Alternative Minimum Tax. Most standard municipal bonds are completely exempt from AMT.
Right.
But if Mayor Mike issues a private activity bond, for example, he uses municipal authority to float debt to build a brand new sports stadium for a private billionaire owner, that triggers the AMT.
So essential purpose bonds like building a public high school or a town hall do not trigger AMT.
Correct.
Private activity bonds, where a corporation benefits heavily from public financing, do trigger AMT.
Exactly.
And what about bank-qualified bonds?
This is one of my favorite trick questions on the exam.
Mm-hmm.
They will ask you, who derives the primary benefit from a bank-qualified municipal bond?
Well, Dave might assume it's some sort of ultra-safe bond for his retail portfolio, but the answer is literally in the name. It benefits the bank.
Specifically, it allows commercial banks to deduct 80% of the interest costs they incur to carry the bonds.
And why does this rule even exist?
Well, Congress realized that tiny municipalities were having a hard time getting massive Wall Street institutions to underwrite their small-town debt.
Oh, sure. Wall Street doesn't care about Mudville.
Exactly. So they created this tax loophole to aggressively incentivize the local community bank down the street to invest their capital into the local town's fire trucks and school buses.
That makes sense.
It keeps local capital flowing into local civic projects.
Okay, so we've evaluated Mayor Mike's issuance, we've corrected Dave's terrible portfolio construction, and we've watched Kathy navigate the tax code. To wrap up our analytical framework, we need to zoom out and look at how Kathy takes the temperature of the entire municipal universe at a macroeconomic level using the bond buyer indexes.
The bond buyer is basically the Wall Street Journal specifically tailored for the municipal bond market.
Right.
They publish several key barometers, and the exam demands that you know precisely how they are formatted.
Okay. We have the 11 bond JIGO index, we have the 20 bond JOE index, we have the revenue bond index, and we have the 40 bond, which is formally called the municipal bond index.
The trap here is purely mechanical memorization, but it catches a lot of test takers. The 11 bond, the 20 bond, and the revenue index are all quoted as weekly yields.
Okay, so they show the average yield of those specific bond profiles.
Right, but the 40 bond index.
The 40 bond index is the outlier. It is the only index in the group quoted as a daily price. Think of it like the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the muni market. It gives traders a daily pulse on price action. 40 equals price, daily.
Yep. The bond buyer also tracks the sheer volume of supply and demand in the market.
Oh, so.
They publish the 30-day visible supply, which aggregates all the new muni bonds slated to hit the market in the next month.
Right. And from a macroeconomic perspective, if the 30-day visible supply is sharply rising, that is considered a bearish indicator for the broader market.
It is.
I want to challenge that, though, because in the equities market, high volume and high supply often mean a booming active market. Why is a high supply of bonds suddenly a bad thing?
It comes down to the most basic law of economics, the supply and demand curve. If the visible supply is aggressively rising, it means a massive tidal wave of new bonds is about to flood the market.
Right.
If you have a massive surge in inventory, but the pool of institutional buyers remains relatively static, the issuers have to offer higher yields to attract capital. And when yields go up, what happens to the prices of existing bonds?
They drop. Downward price pressure.
Exactly.
So a rising visible supply means prices are likely to fall, making it structurally bearish.
But they also track the placement ratio, which is published weekly.
What does that tell us?
The placement ratio measures actual execution. Of all the new bonds offered to the market last week, what percentage were actually purchased by investors and placed into portfolios?
Okay.
A high placement ratio, say, consistently above 90%, is highly bullish.
Because it proves actual aggressive investor appetite. Even if supply is high, a high placement ratio tells you the buyers are hungry and they are clearing the inventory off the shelves as fast as it arrives.
Exactly. If you are Mayor Mike, the most terrifying macroeconomic environment to issue new debt into is one with a massive 30-day visible supply and a plunging placement ratio.
A glut of product and absolutely no buyers.
Exactly.
Okay, take a breath. We have mapped out the entire life cycle of municipal debt, from local property taxes all the way to the federal tax code. It is time to lock this all in with a rapid-fire recap of the most dangerous, highly testable tripwires we covered today.
Let's run the lightning round. I'll tee them up, you knock them down.
Ready.
Number one, Dizzy Dave abandons New York and establishes residency in Texas. What are the immediate consequences to his New York-heavy muni portfolio?
He triggers the double risk. He realizes he has massive geographic concentration risk if New York's economy stumbles, and he permanently loses his in-state tax exemption, completely destroying his taxable equivalent yield.
Spot on. Number two, Mayor Mike abandons the toll road and issues a utility revenue bond to upgrade the Mudville sewer system. What is the standard debt service coverage ratio required by analysts?
1.25x. Water and sewer utilities require a lower safety cushion because their usage is highly inelastic. An essential service is largely recession-proof.
Nice. Number three, the absolute worst-case scenario occurs and Mudville goes completely bankrupt.
Right.
The bonds default. How do these distressed assets trade on the secondary market?
They trade flat. Mechanically, that means the buyer pays zero accrued interest to the seller at settlement because the issuer has ceased making payments.
Correct. Number four, calculating Kathy is on the trading desk, calculating accrued interest between a March 1st and August 1st coupon date for a municipal bond. Which calendar convention does she deploy?
The 3360-day count convention. In the municipal and corporate markets, every single month, including February, has exactly 30 days. You only use the actual literal calendar days if you're trading U.S. Treasuries.
Right. Number five, Dave purchases a premium callable bond. He's mapping out the yield staircase. Which yield represents the absolute floor?
Yield to call is always the lowest mathematically possible yield for a premium callable bond because the capital loss of the premium is compressed into the shortest possible time frame.
Number six, Dave acquires a bond in the secondary market at a deep discount. He is calculating his tax liability, and his discount exceeds the IRS de minimis threshold by exactly 1 cent. What is the tax consequence?
He falls right off the cliff. The capital gains protection is entirely voided, and the whole discount, not just the excess, is taxed as ordinary income.
And finally, number seven, Kathy pulls up the bond buyer to gauge market sentiment. She specifically looks at the 40 bond index. How is this specific index quoted?
The 40 bond index is the singular outlier. It is quoted as a daily price. The 11, the 20, and the revenue indexes are all quoted as weekly yields.
Perfect. If you can internalize the mechanics of why those rules function the way they do, rather than just trying to memorize flashcards, you can deconstruct pretty much any convoluted scenario the exam writers throw at you.
You now understand the motivations of the issuer, the mistakes of the retail trader, and the precision of the institutional analyst. But before we wrap this up, we always like to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought experiment.
I love these.
Something that takes these rigid textbook concepts and applies them to the chaos of the real world.
We spend a lot of time analyzing general obligation bonds and how they rely entirely on the local tax base, specifically assessed property valuations.
Right.
But look at the macro trends regarding climate change, coastal erosion, and the increasing frequency of severe weather events decimating coastal real estate.
Right. I mean, insurance companies are already fleeing certain states entirely.
Exactly. So put yourself in Kathy's shoes. If you are an institutional analyst today, how do you fundamentally underwrite a 30-year general obligation bond for a vulnerable coastal municipality?
Wow, yeah.
The debt obligation is locked in for 3 decades. But if sea levels rise and the coast physically erodes, the actual geography of the tax base might literally shrink and disappear into the ocean before the bond matures.
That's wild to think about.
The debt load remains exactly the same, but the land backing it vanishes. How do you accurately price a 30-year physical risk when the map itself is changing?
The math doesn't change, but the physical collateral does. That fundamentally breaks the standard models.
It really does.
Think on that as you dive back into your studies. Thanks for hanging out with us, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.